There we are back at our history lesson this morning. And for those of you coming in the middle, we are kind of in the middle at this point. And we've talked about phase one of this, what happened in the experience of this group of people who set out to say we're just going to be New Testament Christians. And that they, in the years of 1865, were successful and baptized lots of people. Had they had problems, they had problems. But back in the period of 1865 to 1920 or 1930, they scattered out into three separate communities. And so we talked about that. That's some of the second generation leaders. Didn't have
Get this on tape here.
Yeah, I don't think I had Lipscomb's picture of
there yesterday.
And old brother Daniel Summer.
Sorry, I don't have time to really talk about these personalities because I want to get the interpretive framework before us. Then we talked about some of the particular issues that characterized the separation of the most conservative wing of the movement from others. We'll talk about how those separations take place subsequently. They take place just by people choosing what congregation they're going to be a part of, and choosing what preacher they'll invite, and choosing, making other kind of choices like that. There's a series of doctrinal issues, and these doctrinal issues were debated, discussed. Generally speaking, when people define the divisions, they define them in terms of these issues. That instrumental music were used for the first time in one of these churches in 1849, I think, and it spread fairly rapidly. A missionary society, American Christian Missionary Society, was established in 1849 as well. Actually, there's been little missionary societies. A lot of these people had come out of Baptist churches. They never completely disbanded all their associations. And so that was an issue that was discussed, but it simply became more visible and more important. And then some of the big city churches began to establish pastor systems of organization. Well, so there were issues. But as I suggested to you last time, more significant than the issues, these issues are actually discussed for a long period of time, as issues always are in the Restoration Movement. But what was more significant was the emergence of quite different attitudes toward the Scriptures. And my argument always is that the Restoration Movement actually divides, not because people disagree about a particular issue. In fact, they rather stay together most of the time. When there are disagreements about issues, stay together quite factiously and contentiously. But nonetheless, stay together. They divide when the time comes, when people have quite different attitudes about how do you read the Scriptures. So that there was this conservative element that said what we have to do is still literally go to the Scriptures, literally try to restore New Testament churches. There was a second attitude that says, well, generally speaking, that's what we do. But there are many things that you can't just justify by scriptural text. And then there were, by the end of the 19th century, lots of people who just said, well, we don't do that. And you can't do that. It's not necessary to do that, and it's impossible. So the new hermeneutic is not very new. This hermeneutical kind of concept was quite present in the late 19th century and led to the Disciples of Christ. Now, another way in which you can view what's going on, and this is where we ended up last time, is that there was a sociological spreading out that went on. We looked at Judges, the second chapter, and said that in a sense that's what happened in Israel. That is indeed what happens in all institutions. And religious historians, sociologists, call that the sect-to-denomination process. That religious groups tend to begin as one type that is called by sociologists sects. They don't use it particularly in a pejorative way,
but a sect, a religious sect, is a group that has that believes it is the true religious group. That's evangelistic. Has the, you know, I'll give you a whole list of characteristics. Denominations are religious groups that are more ecumenical and believe that, that all religious groups are okay, and they're just one religious group. They're not very evangelistic. And religious groups tend to go from one of those to the other. Some of you may be familiar with a tract that I wrote 40 years ago, I guess, called The Emergence of the Church of Christ Denomination, in which I use some of these paradigms to describe what happened, what has happened in the Restoration Movement, much as we're doing here. The interesting thing about that, one of the interesting things about that is these changes in religious groups, and I can apply that to the Methodists or the Baptists or all religious groups do that. Actually, nations do it, and businesses do it, and all kinds of institutions tend to go through those kinds of changes. Is that the characteristics of that tend to be social and economic as well as intellectual. That is, as people become wealthier, they want a different kind of religion. So in this country, you know, we got poor churches, poor people's churches, and we got rich people's churches.
If I were doing my American religious history class at Auburn, I'd spend a lecture talking about, you know, class divisions in churches. You would all know that, the Episcopalians are the upper class churches, you know, and then there are the lower class churches. The United Pentecostals or something. I'll tell you my favorite joke that I tell my students about that, to illustrate the class separations in American religion. You ever hear the story of the Episcopalian lady whose dog died, and she went to her priest and said, "Would you preach my dog's funeral?" And he said, "Oh, God, we in our cathedral here," he said, "we couldn't preach a dog's funeral in that in our church." He said, "There's a little Pentecostal church on the other side of the track." He said, "You might go over there, they might do it." And she said, "Well," she said, "okay," she said, "how much do you think I should pay the guy for doing it?" And the priest said, "Oh," he said, "I didn't know you were thinking about paying." He said, "What were you thinking about paying?" And she said, "Well, I thought I'd give him $2,000 or $3,000. He said, "Oh, I didn't know that dog was in Episcopalian." So, okay, there are kind of, churches have kind of economic characteristics. Now, that is quite true in the divisions that take place in the Restoration Movement. I mean, they're just economic parameters. I think I have a, by the way, I've written quite a lot about this. I did an article back in 1964. It's just been published in a little book published by Emily Christian called American Origins of the Church of Christ. There's three kind of pioneer essays, of which mine was the first, in which I do a kind of sociological interpretation. And then an article by Richard Hughes. Richard Hughes? who teaches at Pepperdine. And another. Okay. But anyhow, I point out that this is just obvious. I mean, to say that is not to say anything. You can take the census data that was collected in the censuses in 1936. They collected information on the value of property. The Church of Christ was poor people. The disciples of Christ were the rich people. And that's perfectly obvious. I want to go back to my other thing here. So there are economic parameters. It was a north-south division too. Most of the churches in the north became liberal, disciples churches. Most of the churches of Christ were in the south. And lots of times people ask me, you know, well, why is that? And the only thing I can tell you about that is that I think people in the South were just a little better class of people. Only kidding. That's just another That's just another dimension, really, of the economics of it. I mean, the people in churches in the South were mostly poor churches. They were less educated, tended to be more rural. So, what we have to do is not, is say, well, why was that? The people at the time were quite conscious of that. For instance, they frequently framed what was going on in those terms and said, you know, churches are changing because these people are changing. Daniel Sommer wrote in 1897, his time advanced, such as those cities as assembled in large towns and cities gradually became proud, or at least sufficiently worldly minded to desire popularity. And in order to attain that unscriptural end, they adopted certain popular arrangements, such as a higher pastor, church choir, instrumental music, man-made societies to advance the gospel. In so doing, they divided the brotherhood of disciples. Said, you want to know what's going on? Said, a lot of these people just became fancy and upper class, and they wanted to make the church into something better and more sophisticated, and consequently, they changed. And one gist that we warned them about, whether instrumental music is scriptural, the truth is, these folks had different attitudes about what they wanted to do. And that is true. A board of church extension was established by the end of the 20th century. And what those guys, their attitude was, yeah, what we need is we need to get on the map, you know. We have enough cheap churches. We may be a great church. We may never be, however, with dwarf preachers and insignificant preachers. Well, that's right, see. The problem, if all you got is insignificant preachers, yeah. Not to mention any names. Oh, you're not a dwarf. But people, you know, the time comes. Now we're going to look at this. Obviously, I'm setting us up here for the next couple of days. But it is just to say that the time comes when you get churches full of people who have a different attitude about what the church ought to be. And one of the marks of that is that we need to be somebody. You know? And part of that is, when you become somebody, you know, when the fellow's become a kind of an assistant vice president of the bank, he feels like his church ought to be respectable. And that he ought to have a preacher that speaks good English. And that would really represent the middle group. Then the liberal group, a good kind of quote from one of them, who they begin to distance themselves from these people in the middle, who are just kind of urban, middle-class people. But by the end of the 19th century, what you had is a bunch of fellows who were professors at the University of Chicago. And their attitude was, what they needed, there's a call today for more educated men in the field, more thoroughly trained preachers, more profound thinkers. And I think about that. More cultured, liberal editors, and more scholarly professors. Yeah. So now, if that's what you think you need, and that's your self-identity, and that's who you are, then you make a different kind of church. And it's not just the matter of saying, well, all of a sudden, we came to this time, and people couldn't agree about what the Bible said. I'm going to talk with you about that tonight. I don't believe that's why. People. I don't believe that's why we have division. Not this kind of division. It is rather that the churches, that you get full of churches with different kind of people. And when you get different kind of people with different attitudes and different motives about what they want, then they make different kind of churches. And that's exactly what happened. Okay. I don't know why I've got this here. Go back then. This is where we are. So that you start out with these folks, this generation of folks, who say what we want to do is just reestablish New Testament Christianity. They do a pretty good job, but by the end of the 19th century, they're scattered all over the place with lots of differences. And from that point then, the churches of Christ have a history of their own. And so that's what we'll follow from now on. Now, these other folks have a history, but I'm not going to talk about that, except I'll tell you this. Tell you what happens to them. We're going to talk about the Church of Christ in just a moment. Here's what happens to those other two groups, the 90%. They divide in the 19th 1930s, and formerly in the 1950s. They divide into two separate communities. So that in your community, there'll be Disciples of Christ churches, Christian Church, for instance, Disciples of Christ, which are super liberal, modern Protestant denomination. And then independent Christian churches that tend to be fairly conservative, evangelical type denominations. The issues that they divided over are interesting because we'll see, they reappear. The issues that they divided over were essentially theological modernism, which came along at the end of the 19th century, and argued that, either that took a postmodernist view of the Bible, said that the Bible was not literally the Word of God, and some of those people disagreed about that. That's called higher criticism. And they also divided about social gospel issues. And they divided over the question of open membership. That is, many of those liberal people came to say that obviously our church is just another denomination like all other denominations, and we need to recognize that. And they welcomed people in from other churches. So they also gave up the significance of baptism that had long been preached and welcomed all denominationalists into their midst. So they divided on that issue. They also had different attitudes. And as the liberal disciples of Christ had an attitude toward the scriptures of a modernist or liberal who said that the Bible can't be literally understood, the conservative Christian church, that is not the case. I would characterize the attitude within the conservative Christian church as a denominational and traditional attitude. That is, they were loyal, kind of, to the Christian church. Now I want you to, set that aside for later. You see, there are many people who are quite orthodox. There are people who are quite orthodox in the end of the 19th century who simply, however, understand who they are. They understand who they are propositionally. That they are who they are and that they are the true church because they do these true things. And consequently, if someone comes along and challenges one of those things, they're actually loyal to the traditional doctrine rather than they're loyal to the plea to restore New Testament Christianity. And actually, in many ways, I find those people more intransigent than anyone else in the Restoration movement because they become wedded to essentially what is a denominational concept of who they are. And they're wedded to that group. Now, there's also a sociological pattern, and that is while most of these people were better off than the people who left in the Churches of Christ. They were soon outflanked by this new intelligentsia who looked down on middle-class people and in many ways held them in disrepute. And so they are the ones who, by and large, it will be the disciples who capture all the old institutions of all of the first-generation colleges. They all went with the disciples of Christ, with the liberal group. You can take every college, Bethany, Texas Christian, Butler, Drake, Hiram, a whole series of colleges that have been established. Colleges, intellectuals always go in the liberal direction. Okay. Now, I've got to talk about this. Let me talk. This is an important point. So I hope we get beyond this morning. But let me talk with you then about division within the Restoration movement. What happens that you've got this movement and it seems that we can't agree with one another? And what I want to suggest to you is that there are two kinds of divisions that take place in the movement. And it's important to distinguish between those two kinds of divisions. Both of them, I think, are unfortunate. But one type of division that takes place is what I call division among like-minded people. That is, in phase one of Restoration history, or in phase three of the history of the Churches of Christ, that we'll see in a few minutes, it's not as if everything is idyllic and everybody agrees with one another. They do not. And in fact, There's just lots of dividing that goes on. But it essentially is dividing that takes place among people, all of whom have the same attitude toward the Scriptures. And that is an attitude of saying, we want to do exactly what's right. Now, it can be personality division. Actually, the stone camel people had some difficulties getting together. Others developed personal followings like Redneck. There were divisions that took place because of doctrinal eccentricities. That is, sometimes someone will come along and espouse a doctrinal view. The most divisive one in Restoration history has been premillennial views. That is so deviant that it just can't be accommodated. And consequently, those people will leave. Now they generally speaking, might well be people who are arguing from the same scriptural basis that everybody else is. But they take a position that's deviant enough from the view of others that they can't stay together. There's social and cultural divisions. I mean, churches debated about slavery in the pre-Civil War period. And certainly the Civil War had a divisive impact. All of those kinds of divisions take place within a congregational and personal context. As congregations divide regularly, you can't divide the denomination because there isn't any denomination. And consequently, what people do is people tend to gather together in homogeneous congregations. I believe, you know, that the Lord had that in mind when he understood that that is what we would do. So, now, some of those kinds of divisions may be quite wrong. I mean, God will surely hold people responsible for dividing when they should not. But some of them are natural. I mean, it's just, as I say, in an open-ended movement where there is no creed, there is no authority to impose will, there's no organization that controls congregations, then what you're going to have is you're going to have this wild democracy. And I'm not upset by that. Now, I'm going to talk with you by Friday about some people are upset by that. And now I will tell you what you can do. Is you can fall off two ends with that. You can say what a liberal will say, what a disciple of Christ liberal will say by this point is, hey, this is not working. You can't do it. And so let's just kick it. And so what's the alternative? Well, the alternative is, if that won't work, we'll just make one that suits us. We'll just make a church that suits us, which is what everybody has done. So you can say, okay, the plea won't work. And people do that all the time. You can become very sectarian and say, well, we've got all these divisions, and so that won't work. That implies that God's made a mess of things. And consequently, what I'm going to do is I'm going to get my list of things that make the true Church of Christ, and this is what the true Church of Christ is, and you got to do this. Now, that's the sectarian option. And people do that. People do that all along the spectrum. But that abandons the plea. That's not what the plea is. The plea is that what we're going to do is honestly be disciples of Jesus Christ and go back again and again and say, I'm going to do to the very best of my ability as a person and then working with a group of Christians to be like New Testament Christians. But at any rate, that's the kind of tension that we always exist in. Now, that's division among like-minded people. I'll come back to that again. Obviously, we're going to meet it again. But you see, I believe that we go through times when essentially everybody is conservative. That is, everybody believes in the plea and says, well, what I want to do is just restore New Testament Christianity. But everybody doesn't end up exactly the same place. But, for instance, I'll tell you one quick story about that. I was talking with my friend Sewell Hall one time, who holds the position on 1 Corinthians 11 that a woman should wear a covering. And I don't. And Sewell said to me, he said, well, you know, he said, you're a very conservative fellow, which I am. I'm actually eccentric. But he said, you're a very conservative fellow. But he said, on that issue, I am more conservative than you are. I said, no, you're not. He said, yeah, on that issue, I'm more conservative than you. I said, no, you're not. Nobody's more conservative than me on any issue. Because I believe in doing exactly what the scriptures say about every issue, and you can't be no more conservative than that. Now, I believe it teaches something different than what you believe it teaches in 1 Corinthians, the 11th chapter. But that's a base. If what you say is everybody is like-minded and everybody's saying, I believe you have to apply every scripture exactly as God intended it. Somebody might have a more restrictive position than me on some issue, but he won't have a more conservative one. Because if you disagree with me about something, what we need to do is just talk about the Bible, because I believe in doing exactly what the scriptures instruct us to do. So that's the common ground now. Now, we have to recognize that exists. But now what we've been talking about this morning is a different kind of division. And we need to recognize the difference between these, because it's quite significant. In that, occasionally, what happens is, the movement spreads out theologically, it spreads out sociologically, to include different kind of people with different minds. And when that happens, then you have a very different kind of division. And that's the kind of sorting out that we've just looked at. And that is, I believe that's what Paul's talking about in 1 Corinthians 11:19, when he says, for there must also be heresies among you, that they which are approved may be made manifest. He said, I will tell you what heresies do and division. He says, the time comes that if there wasn't a kind of a sorting out, you wouldn't be able to find it anymore. I mean, a lot of times people say, isn't it a shame if we were all together, if just the whole restoration movement was back together, well, we'd be 5 million people. Well, the problem with that is we're not together. And, who would know what the message was if that was true? So what he says is that there's a kind of a natural sorting out. Otherwise, he said the message would be lost. That those who are approved would not be manifest. So there are these two types of division. There's a division among people that were like-minded, and then there's separations among people that have divided minds, who have different attitudes toward the scripture. And those have broad intellectual and sociological foundations. People just get scattered out, and they're quite different. And these divisions, and by the way, we're going to look at them, these divisions are not neat. They're never just three groups of people. People are actually scattered all along this spectrum. But everybody has to find it, figure out where they're going to live their life. And what I want to tell you is that, in my opinion, these are not divisions that somebody causes, or even that some issue causes. These are things that happen because that's the natural spreading out of people. And I believe it's really important to understand that. Now, we're going to look at the divisions in the Church of Christ in the 20th century. And there are a list of issues. The issues were debated. Everybody has to define themselves by issues. But issues don't cause it. Actually, every issue has always been around for a long time. A whole generation will live with it. A whole generation will have dinner on the ground before somebody raises a question and says, you ought to have dinner on the ground. Everybody has participated in sponsoring church arrangements. And people talk about them. But I believe that we have a great capacity to live with differences. And so men don't cause them. Sometimes men think they cause them. I'm kind of the historical persuasion, by the way, that men don't make history. History makes men. That is, things happen, and they reach up and grab the people who fit the times. But at any rate, we can get in their mind, oh, so-and-so would just mean he came along, he wrecked the church. No, nobody can do that. What happens is that these big, broad separations come along. And when they do, they spread people out. Well, let's see where we're going next. Oh, now, if you wanted to have a scriptural text for this sociological lesson that we've just done this morning, 1 Corinthians 1:26 would be it, wouldn't it? For you see your calling, brethren, had it not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called. Would it surprise you if, actually what he says is look around at the church and see who's in the church in Corinth. He said, I'll tell you who's in it. Mostly just poor people who are in it. And so would it surprise you that if the church had a sociological characteristic and it was mostly plain and poor people? That, those are the people who are willing to say, well, I'll humble myself and do exactly what the scriptures do. I got to quit. But those of you heard my lesson Monday, I told you that story about the professor that I used to talk to all the time, who would argue with me about the scriptures, and every time I'd try to prove something to him, he'd, by a text, he'd say, I don't see that, I don't see it, and I finally figured out he didn't see it. Anyhow, he got mad with me one day, and he said, I don't believe you believe all that religion stuff. He said, what do you ever do about your religion? And he knew I preached, and he knew I talked to him. I try to teach people. I try to go to somebody's house at least once every week and teach them. And he said, well, you never have been to my house. And that was right. I never had, but I'd talked to him, I thought, plenty. But I told him, now I got you down. I got you down. Got you on my prospect list. I've got you down as the worst prospect in town. So, you know, we can all kind of sort it out where the good prospects are and where the bad prospects are. And Paul said, don't be surprised about where they are. If what you're selling is humble yourself and submit yourself and go to the scriptures and do exactly what they say, then I can tell you where most likely you'll find some folks who won't do that. I never have converted a colleague at the university. I've had some good Christian friends who were on faculty. I never have converted one. Converted two secretaries. I've converted a couple of cleaning people. But never have converted one of the professors. Doesn't surprise me. Where are we going next? Next, we're going to the next phase. Next, I'm going to talk about what happens in the churches of Christ from 1900 to 1950, and then, let's see, we just got two more days, so I'll try to get even past that phase into phases 4 and 5. With what happens in the churches of Christ from 1900 to 1950, I'll tell you what happens is they grow like wildfire. So that by 1950, by the end of World War II, churches of Christ probably are bigger than the Disciples of Christ Christian Church movement. They're certainly much bigger now. So, we'll look at why that happens. You know, it happens, but I'll just give you a hint. Of course, it happens because when this division came, the churches of Christ got all of the really sophisticated preachers. No, they didn't get any of them, actually. You had a bunch of country clods. And but they were organized. They had good organization. No, it's the other guys that had good organization. They didn't have any organization. They were called Andys. I'll ever tell you that story, and then I'll quit. When I first started teaching up in East Tennessee, there were a bunch of churches up in East Tennessee from this conservative Christian church. Some of them had me in class, some of the boys had me in class, and they knew I'd written about the Restoration Movement, but they didn't know where I belonged in all this jumbo, you know. And so one of them finally found out I was a member of the Church of Christ, and he said to me, he said, oh, Dr. Harrell, he said, I discovered that you're an anti, by which he meant I was anti-instrumental music and anti-missionary society. And I said, son, I said, you have no idea. I said, I am an anti. That is, I have done that twice. So that what you'll see is a separating that takes place later on too. But in the 1950s, first half of the 20th century, churches just go real fast and come out of World War II just on a high, booming, and growing, but also deeply troubled. Okay.
Well, we'll take it. Thank you.